From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with one of the most highly regarded managers in baseball. Tony La Russa guided his Oakland A's into the World Series last year and into first place this year, and he's twice been named Manager of the Year. Also today, we talk with animator John Lasseter. His film Tin Toy made movie history this year when it became the first computer animation to win the Oscar. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the avant-garde bands Pere Ubu and The Residents. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest work by master spy novelist John le Carré. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The Oakland A's are the defending American League champions and the favorites to win again this year. They've held first place in the American League West for the past couple of weeks and have the best winning percentage in baseball. My guest is the manager of the A's, Tony La Russa. Last year, he was voted Manager of the Year by the Baseball Writers Association of America. He was also given that honor in 1983 when he led the Chicago White Sox to the division championship. La Russa is one of only five managers in baseball history with a law degree. During his playing career, he was a utility infielder. He became the manager of the White Sox in 1979, was dismissed in July of 86, and signed with the A's just a few days later. I recorded an interview with Tony La Russa last week when Fresh Air visited San Francisco. The A's had won big on Monday, lost on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, the day we spoke, they were tied for first place. I asked La Russa what kind of talk he has with the team after they lose.
Well, it's a tricky thing. Talking to your players is tricky in the sense that if you have a formal meeting after every ballgame that you lose, then you're going to wear out the effect of you meeting with the team.
Because
you play for 6 months, 162 games, and if you have a great year and you win 100 games, you're going to lose 62. So I think you have to be very careful when how many times you actually stand before the team and say, let's get together because I have something to say. What you do is more walk through the clubhouse. If you have a point, like last night, I thought we were a little sloppy in a couple of things. You walk through the clubhouse, you say it while they're out getting undressed, and you walk out. The next day is always a good thing to keep in mind because after a ball game, if you're upset, it may come out wrong. I try to watch that carefully because it's crucial. You can go in there and make a bad situation worse or you can do it properly. I noticed, for example, a guy that I respect a great deal, Roger Craig, who manages the Giants here. I think he's outstanding. They had about as heartbreaking a loss as you can have on Monday night when we were winning. And he was quoted as saying the worst thing he could have done was to go in the clubhouse and ripped his team apart because their heart was broken. They had played as hard as they could. They could have played better, but they couldn't have played harder. And that, to me, is a key thing, Terry. These guys are men, not machines. You look for effort first. And then you recognize that sometimes the execution's not going to be there because you just can't be perfect. So what Roger did was just, hey, we'll get them tomorrow. It was a tough loss. They came out yesterday, and I think they scored like 13 runs. So there's definitely a proper way to do it.
What do you tell a player who could have played harder?
Well, that's the one thing that you cannot tolerate. And if you make it a point of standing up before the team and saying something's important to you, then your credibility is at stake. So, for example, in my case, very clearly I state effort is the number one thing I look for day in and day out. So if you see somebody who shorts you the effort, not only is that person, your relationship with that person affected, but all the other teammates, they're watching. So if somebody gets by with not running a ball out or not getting the job done because they just physically didn't give you the effort, if you turn the other... You know, turn your cheek or ignore it, it's going to have an effect on the player and the whole team. So in effort, now, when it comes to effort, I usually treat that right now. I'll do it right during the game. I'll mention it. If for some reason something is distracting immediately after the game, usually in the privacy of my office, but if I think it's important enough, I think you have to confront a player right in the clubhouse.
In front of other players?
In front of other players. But that's a drastic one, I think. If you... nail a guy coming off the field in front of everybody in the dugout, it's got to be something severe.
I want to read you something that Bill James wrote about you back in 1984 in describing you as a manager. See what you think of this. Bill James wrote, Tony La Russa's strategy is calculated to play on the opposing team's mind, to disrupt them. He probably does that as effectively as any other manager. Do you think that describes you as a manager, as your strategy?
I think that's part of it.
How do you do it then? What's an example of, you know, disrupting the opposing team's mind?
Well, I just, you know, a lot of what I do as far as strategy is trying to remember when I played. So as an example of what we try to do to disrupt the other team, it's more not necessarily disrupt, but just to keep them occupied. Last night, we were losing 3-1. The number two run potentially got to base. Walter Weiss walked in the eighth inning. Tying run's not a bet. Normally, you don't do much with the guy on first base because you don't want to lose that runner and then lose the ability to tie the game with the guy at the plate. Well, we stole second, and then we stole third. Now, Walter ended up scoring a sacrifice fly, became a 3-2 game. We ended up not tying or winning that game. But the point was, from now on, when we play the Yankees or anybody else that was scouting us, they'll know, even when they're behind, the A's will steal. So anytime that you put the thought of the steal in their minds, number one, the pitcher is a little bit leery of the game. The catcher is concerned. The infielders are moving around. When a guy gets to second base, for example, and they know, I mean, it's a stab. I think probably Bill James a couple years later would have said in 1988 or 87, the A's led the major leagues in stealing third base. So that means when you play against the A's and a guy gets a second, one of your two infielders, a second baseman and a shortstop, is going to have to shorten up and take the stolen base away. So when he does that, he opens up a hole for the hitter. And those are the kind of things I think that we try to do offensively and defensively. And just give the club a lot of looks and get them concerned because it's too easy to play against us the other way.
Tony La Russa is my guest, manager of the Oakland A's. Let's talk about disciplining players, which is something that has to be a concern of yours as a manager. An example, Jose Canseco recently has had several problems in addition to his broken wrist. He was picked up for driving at 120 miles an hour. He picked up a friend at an airport who was carrying a loaded gun, and then Canseco's own loaded gun was found on the seat of his car. What kind of talk did you have with him about that afterwards?
I think you, as a manager, you have to separate the personal and the professional, whether it's your own personal and professional life, but especially here, players. In Jose's personal life, what he did this winter, going or not going to a card show, picking up a guy in the airport, driving fast, going to a doctor's appointment and having a gun in his car. That personal side, you have certain limitations as a manager as to what discipline and effect you can have. I think the number one thing you try to do is you try to establish respect and credibility with the player so that he'll come to you if he figures that he has a real problem or he hasn't got it covered. The professional side now, if he comes to the ballpark 30 minutes late, there's all kind of discipline that I can affect. If in a game he chooses to ignore my signal, you know, to run, to bunt, whatever, there's all kind of things I can do. If he chooses not to run hard, effort that we were talking about, you know, at the game now, one of my pet peeves is you read now about, and you know, I just read Roger Angel's New Yorker piece, you know, where there's this feeling among older baseball people that you just can't discipline players anymore. They do whatever they want to. That's baloney. Are the players today, yeah, in some situations a manager may let them get away with everything, but most managers still make them, you know, dot their I's and cross their T's. You can take their money. The argument is they're making so much money, so fines don't count. They still don't want to give the money up. You also have the power of the lineup card. You don't have to play them. Even Jose Canseco, if he is going crazy, not paying attention to signs, not hustling, we're better off with Jose sitting than having this great talent playing out of control. And last but not least, it's just a personal confrontation. I mean, these guys are just men, and they do not want to be challenged or embarrassed or directly told, hey, you know, you're really messing up and you're discrediting everything. So there's all kind of ways that you can discipline a player professionally, and I just think it's important that when you see a player like Jose or anybody, that when you see a problem, is it a professional problem, is it a personal problem, and you recognize that there are limitations as far as a manager or an organization when it gets to the personal side.
When we're talking about discipline, Do you think that there should be kind of across-the-board rules that are applied to everybody on the team, or do you prefer to handle it on a case-by-case basis, depending on the temperament and the personality of the player who violated one of your rules?
That's a great question. Without specific examples, I'll do my best to answer it. And I'm not trying to straddle the fence. I think generally you have rules that apply across the board. I basically have two, three. Mm-hmm. Get to the park on time. Do not tolerate you being late. Give me your very best effort. And three, with that effort, try to play the game as good as you possibly can. Because this baseball is a game of execution and ideas. You just can't go out there crazy. You know, you have to play with ideas. So if somebody violates a rule and he's a veteran or he's a rookie, yes, generally they apply the same to all. But, you know, I take into account what's happening. If you have a veteran who's established that he's an outstanding pro and for some reason didn't run this ball out and has run every ball out his whole career, hey, come on, Carney, that's not you. I say Carney Lancer because he's on our club, one of our best examples of a guy who plays his heart out. If he didn't run a ball out, you know, I know it's just an aberration, something that, you know, whatever, just he just blanked out for a second. That's not you. If you want to say anything, you don't have to. If a guy who hasn't established his reputation, I'm sure I would be more forceful and would not dodge anything. So I think generally you do apply it across the board, but, and here's a trick to it, I don't think that you can avoid trying to evaluate each situation and trying to figure out what's right here and there and then and now. And, you know, that may leave you open to some second guessing among the players. Well, you know, he's being inconsistent, but I think if you pay attention to what you're doing, you can be perfectly consistent and still be reasonable with the players.
Let me ask you about a few things very briefly. When you're in some kind of dispute or trying to discipline a player who's very high paid and getting paid a lot more money than you are, does it make it hard for you to have the kind of power and authority that you want in that situation?
Good question, and I think one that's very much misunderstood. The answer is absolutely not.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it used to be if I'd said that, well, how do you know for sure? Well, I've been doing it 10 years now. I know. Number one, I never talk to the player about money. Therefore, it's not an issue. I don't care if the guy's making $1 million, $2 million, or he's a rookie making 60. Never talk to him. The issue or whatever the problem is has to do with something on the field. So the relative salary between us has nothing to do with it. Second, I think I've learned, you are the manager. You are a man in authority. And if you are willing to take the authority and exert it, you will be paid the proper due. So, no, I don't think the salary difference has anything to do with it.
Let's talk about arguing with umpires. Something that all managers do. Something I think that you used to do more of than you do now.
Definitely. You came on early, you're trying to show the team that you're going to fight for them. You're trying to, you know, you're so anxious to have your club compete. And sometimes the umpires, they're there, they're convenient, and you take out your frustration on them. I think definitely over the years, I've definitely toned down. I've really realized it's a lot of wasted energy. I mean, these guys are out there, have probably the toughest job on the field every day, and I try to treat them with respect. You go out there for a legitimate argument, you argue quickly, and you get out. And basically, this is something I tell the team too. We're going to direct almost entirely all of our energies towards beating the other team. The umpire's not going to beat us, so let's not use them to get ourselves going, and let's not abuse them. If you think, because they're not what's getting us beat. So I think over the last half dozen years or so, I think my relationship with the umpires has definitely improved, and it's something that I had to change because there's a better way to do it, and that's realizing. Just paying them the respect that they're due and concentrate on the opposing team and not the umpires.
When you do argue with an umpire, does your legal background ever come in handy?
Nah. Nothing comes in handy when you work with umpires.
Right.
There's nothing going to help. Early on, they would kid me about it a little bit because, you know, I had played for a long time in my league, so a lot of these men I knew. It was more a matter of kidding. But I got to say, basically, you go out there if you have a legitimate argument, you say it quickly and you get out because you're not going to change anybody's mind.
Okay, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Tony La Russa, manager of the Oakland A's. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tony La Russa is my guest, manager of the Oakland A's. Last year they made it to the World Series, and La Russa was for the second time named Manager of the Year by the Baseball Writers Association of America. There's an old saying in baseball about how, you know what I'm going to say here, that the best managers are mediocre players usually make really good managers. And you were a mediocre player when you were...
That's the kindest thing to say. I was worse than mediocre.
Well, I think your batting average was .200.
Gave me 2 points about 198.
198, okay. So is there truth in that, do you think?
I think there's some truth in it, and I'm not making any claim about what I am as a manager, but I think there's no doubt in my mind that if you're a scuffling-type player that had to survive, in your scuffles, you would have had to learn a lot of the pieces of the game and play them to your max amount. You were not able to neglect base running or defensive positioning or the handling of how pitchers are handled. Sometimes if you're a better player, if you're an outstanding hitter or something or an outstanding pitcher, then you can just do your strength so well that pieces of it are not that necessary unless you personally make it a point to be a complete player. That, to me, is the formula. So if I look at a star, I know a star can be an outstanding manager, but did that star have enough interest in the total game to be involved and really want to be a great base runner? So if you see a player who does it all and really loves the game, well, just being a star doesn't mean he's not going to be a good manager. If you're not a good player, to survive, you're forced to learn a lot about the game. And then when you get into it, I think, number one, you have those lessons. But number two, I think you do have, and here's probably the key call, Terry, I think you have a certain appreciation of the different ranks of players. You know, I really believe that I understand what a guy who's struggling as a young player is trying to do, a bench player, a veteran player just coming off the peak of his years. So I'm not sure sometimes the star gets that appreciation unless he really is people interested.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that you were signed the night that you graduated from high school? Must have been some night.
Yes, it was. It was an exciting time for a young player back then because there was no draft. So it was back when anybody who was interested could court you. And at those days, there was 24 major league teams, and I had 20 contract offers of the 20. It was only four teams that did not express an interest. So it was, you had people coming in, they'd take you to dinner. They would, Charlie Finley personally flew down from Chicago to meet our family. So it was a very exciting, and it was, you thought, wow, if 20 clubs are interested, I must have some ability. And the fact was, graduation night when we came back to my parents' home, there were three scouts' cars parked outside waiting to talk to me about which club to go with.
Was it disappointing for you to have been courted the way you were and to be given so much money to sign with the A's and then to not fulfill that promise? Did you feel like a failure when you were starting in baseball?
My answer is no. I'll tell you why. It ended up being adversity that you grow with. I mean, there's no doubt. I mean, everybody that has had any success will tell you they had adversity. They dealt with it. It made them stronger. And then later on, not only were they better for it, but they appreciated their success. So in my case, I was always injured. So to me, I can always, I don't talk about it much. But if push came to shove, if I had stayed healthy, I think I would have been a pretty good player. Mm-hmm. I hurt my arm, I hurt my back, it goes on and on and on. So if I had stayed healthy, I think I'd have been a reasonable major leaguer. But I wasn't. So my adversity was, and this is where I came out stronger, was I did not give in to the injuries. Now, if you look at my career from the 62 season that I signed through about 67, it was ridiculous. I mean, was that five-year period, six-year period? I was hurt like four times in a major way. So what I learned about myself was that I wasn't a quitter, that I could play with pain, and that it meant enough to me to start something and finish something. So later on, as I started getting healthier, I ended up having some pretty decent years, especially in AAA. But I was then, I wouldn't say a fraction of what, but I couldn't throw very well anymore. You know, my mobility was cut back. But I still played for 15 years. So when I quit, I knew that although my talents had been limited, I knew that I had some internal strength, that, you know, that I could deal with pain, and I wasn't a quitter.
We talk about pain and injuries. I think it was in 1963, the year that you were first signed. You injured your shoulder or a tendon while playing, and you didn't tell anybody. So you went through spring training without reporting the injury. And did you do permanent? Well, why didn't you tell anybody, first of all?
Well, I had a chance to make the major league team. It was, you know, one of those bonus baby provisions where if they want to keep you, they can choose to keep you on the big league team. And I knew I was one of the guys being considered. So I felt like I could fake it, and you know, the more that I threw with it, finally it ended up tearing. I had a tendon problem in my throwing shoulder, right arm, ended up tearing. But that was, you know, I was just trying to survive at that point, and you know, just not smart enough to realize, you know, if I hurt my throwing arm as an infielder, it's not going to be very good for my career down the road. But you know, I never said I was smart.
So did you permanently injure?
Yes, even to this day, if I play catch, that one little spot right there is going to be sore. And what happened was the rest of my career, I tried to adjust my throwing. They moved me to second base because, I mean, it became pretty obvious that I couldn't throw like I used to. And I started flipping the ball, so you end up affecting your elbow. I got chips in my elbow, and now you're an infielder that has a sore elbow and a sore shoulder. The only reason that I survived was that I ended up coping. You know, I got to where I was a very heady base runner. I ended up being a decent hitter. Yeah, I mean, I like you said, I hit 198 in the major league, but I was about 270 in the minor league. So even though I wasn't doing everything that you had to as an infielder to be outstanding at the big league level, I was still a productive minor league player. So, you know, later on when I started to manage, a lot of the stuff that I went through in the minor leagues and in my career really paid off in the sense that, I mean, I appreciated and I understood.
We probably tell players now not to go back on the field too soon.
That's one of the things that, I mean, we go through it all the time because, you know, guys are always coming up with problems. And I think it's pretty standard here. Like, you know, we have a guy currently, Tony Phillips, who's hitting 320 and technically has been about available to play. And as we tape this show, if you know, in my pocket here, I've got a card for tonight's lineup, and there's two guys at second base. It's Tony, one of them. He had an ankle, twisted his ankle the other day, and he's about ready to play, but I keep thinking about this, and if I don't play him tonight, it's just because of his ankle. And I can remember, I said, you know what's going to happen is this guy's going to re-injure it. So I'm very careful with injuries.
Tony La Russa is my guest, manager of the Oakland A's. You're one of only five managers in the history of baseball who also have had law degrees. When did you get yours?
Well, at the end of this mediocre playing career, you know, it was when it became obvious to me that I wasn't going to be a good major leaguer and make enough money to sustain my family, I got to do something else. And when I signed graduation night high school, you know, I signed this contract because my dad really wanted me to play pro ball, and I wanted to. My mother was very interested in education, so I said, Mom, I'll get that undergraduate degree. So I did. During the off season, I got my undergraduate degree there at University of South Florida in Tampa. Later in my life now, when I'm getting to the end of baseball, I felt the other thing that I can do when I leave baseball is become a lawyer. You know, I love to read. I like solving problems, and I had friends who were lawyers. So I started going to law school during the off season, surely figuring that I was going to finish playing ball any one of these years, finish my law degree, become a lawyer. So I started in 73 and went every winter. It took me five winters. But what happened was about the end of the 76 winter season, the managing bug kind of bit me. So I was actually going to be a lawyer before I was going to be a manager.
Uh-huh.
And then it just, I figured, because of a combination of things, talked it over with my wife, Elaine. The day that I quit playing, it almost coincided with the day that I was going to graduate from law school. Why don't I take one shot to manage, get it out of my system? Because I had been a player coach under a great man named Lauren Babe, and he had kind of fueled my interest. So I tried to manage, and everything, I'm telling you, if I talk to you about my first few years managing, everything fell into place. I got to the big leagues very quickly, and therefore, law became something that got shoved aside. But at one point, I was going to be a lawyer as soon as my playing career was over, But the managing thing, I just caught every break in the world.
Anything about law come in handy for you as a manager?
I think so. I'm careful when I say this because I've seen outstanding managers. You know, I think the best right now in our league is Sparky Anderson. And some of the things that he does, he didn't go to law school. So he learned his lesson, his places. And you look at other managers. But for me, I think the attention to detail and the preparation that they teach you in school will give you an edge in a case. I've become convinced in my own mind that if I come into a series against a team, if I'm prepared in my own case down to the last detail, if the team is prepared, we'll have our best chance to win. So I think that's one carryover.
Any false assumptions made about you because you have a law degree?
Yeah, I think early on I had this giant, like it was almost an anvil on my back. It's almost like people in baseball, because I was not a major leaguer for very much as a player. I think in the minor leagues, most people knew me as just a guy who loved baseball and played hard. But the major league level, when I got into major league managing, a lot of people who didn't really know me thought, hey, here's a guy that's getting publicity for being a lawyer. And they really, I think, misunderstood me. And so I definitely had to overcome that because, I kind of resented it because there's no doubt in my mind that ever since 1962, so you count the years, more than half my life I've been a professional baseball person, and I'm very proud of it. And for somebody to come and say, hey, he's a lawyer who's slumming as a baseball manager, really bothered me, and I think that stereotype took me several years to get by with baseball people. I think they finally realized, hey, this guy's just... That's just what he happened to do in the offseason, but he's basically a baseball man. And like I say, I'm very proud of it.
Let me ask you to remember one of your baseball memories from childhood, one of the things that really hooked you on the game.
Most of them, I have three or four that come to mind real quickly. One, I lived in Ybor City in Tampa, mm-hmm. Which was a hotbed of baseball, kind of a Latin-Italian community. Baseball all the time, so a very short walk to the park. They used to have something called the Intersocial League, which is a semi-pro league, played on Thursday night and Sunday afternoon. And a real plum was being the scoreboard keeper. So, they had a manual scoreboard in center field, and you sat in a wheelbarrow between the balls and the strikes. And because it was obvious that I loved the game, when I was very young, they gave me that job. And you used to get, I believe it was $3 on Thursday night and $5 for the Sunday doubleheader. So one of my best memories was just sitting there in center field, being the ball strike, get up and put the outs and put the score up and get to watch this game on Thursday night and the doubleheader on Sunday. And I'd always, on Sunday, then I'd go to the ballpark with my dad, who's would always follow me wherever I went. And then if it was a weekday, another memory that I have was, we lived upstairs above a service station. And there was an alley, and my mom, because my dad worked all the time, my mom would play catch with me in the alley. That's when I was real young. And you remember those things. And that's some of my strongest memories.
Tony La Russa, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about baseball and your life. Thank you.
Okay, Terry, thank you for having me.
Tony La Russa is the manager of the Oakland A's. They're currently in first place in the American League West. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with South African writer Nadine Gordimer. Her novels and books of short stories include A Sport of Nature and The Soft Voice of the Serpent. Her new book of essays, The Essential Gesture, explores her thoughts on being a white writer in South Africa, committed to fighting apartheid. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Animator John Lasseter got his start working at the Disney Studios, but he's traded in his pens and inks for a keyboard and a computer screen. Coming up, John Lasseter talks about his Oscar-winning computer animation. Also, rock historian Ed Ward examines a pair of bands that broke new ground in rock's avant-garde, Pere Ubu and The Residents. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Russia House. It's the new novel from John le Carré, author of the bestsellers The Spy Who Came in from the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and The Little Drummer Girl. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Pro-democracy demonstrations continued a million strong in Beijing today amid growing signs of a power struggle within the Chinese leadership. It appears that Premier Li Peng may be losing ground in his effort to crush the popular protest under martial law. President Bush today met for over an hour with Juan Li, chairman of China's National People's Congress, the country's nominal parliament. Earlier today, Juan announced he was cutting short his visit to the U.S. He returns to China tonight. Details from NPR's Anne Garrels.
When the meeting was over, Juan Li avoided reporters' questions, and President Bush maintained a low-key approach to China's crisis. In a statement issued this afternoon, the president merely reiterated his commitment to democracy. He urged nonviolence and restraint. He also urged that the Voice of America radio broadcast not be jammed. Juan Li was to have stayed on in the United States for the rest of the week. While he gave no reason for his speedy return, it is fueled speculation he plans to call a special meeting of the National People's Congress to discuss the current situation. According to China experts, Premier Li Peng had no authority to impose martial law this week, because under the new constitution drawn up in 1982, the National People's Congress must approve such a move. Juan Li helped write that new constitution, and experts see this as a test for the constitution as well as the Congress. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Secretary of State James Baker said today that strategic arms talks between the U.S. and Soviet Union will resume on June 19th. The goal of the so-called START talks is a 50% reduction in superpower stockpiles of intercontinental ballistic missiles. Baker made the announcement as he began a briefing on President Bush's trip to Europe for the NATO summit later this month. In Czechoslovakia, Western journalists have been allowed for the first time to watch the partial pullout from the country of Soviet forces. Edward Lucas was there and prepared this report.
A brass band, military top brass, and a few impassive Czechoslovaks watched 10 Red Army tanks clank their way aboard a train homeward bound to the Soviet Union, where they'll be either scrapped or recycled. General Yuri Chepin told me, "We're not talking, we're acting." It's part of President Gorbachev's unilateral initiative announced in December to withdraw 500,000 men and 10,000 tanks from Eastern Europe over the next 2 years. Thousands more tanks still remain. A foreign ministry spokesman said the Soviets hope many more can go.
Our proposal now is to destroy 40,000 tanks, our tanks and the tanks of North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
Although Soviet tanks crushed Czechoslovakia's reform experiment 21 years ago, there's still no sign of their withdrawal or anything else shaking the position of the hardline communist rulers they installed. For National Public Radio, this is Edward Lucas in Prague.
Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir today dismissed as useless a Middle East policy speech given yesterday by Secretary of State James Baker. Baker appealed to Israel to give up any plans for annexation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip, and he called for Israel to think of Palestinians in the occupied territories as neighbors deserving political rights. A summit of Arab nations is underway in Casablanca, Morocco. Libya's Muammar Gaddafi showed up for the conference despite an intended boycott. Morocco's King Hassan embraced most of the Arab leaders as they arrived, but gave a cool greeting to rival Gaddafi. Egypt returns to its chair with the League after a 10-year absence to discuss the two critical topics, possible reinstatement of Israel into the League and the continuing Lebanese civil war. Stock prices fell sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 24 points to close at 2477.82. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. In the 70s, disco and glitter rock were the rage on the radio and in clubs. But during that period, there was also some very adventurous music that was less commercially viable. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward explores two groups that exemplify the 70s rock avant-garde in America.
Creativity can come from two places, determination and reaction. You can decide to do something, or you can be forced into it by circumstance. The main difference is that, over time, determination can give you a long run, while reaction can force you to draw up short and reconsider your course. These thoughts came to me as I was considering the horrible wasteland that was rock and roll during the 70s, and how, whether by determination or reaction, a tiny rock and roll avant-garde appeared at that time, one whose effects are still being felt. In this country, it consisted for the most part of two groups, as different as could be, Pere Ubu and the Residents.
Santa dogs at Jesus' feet, the Santa dogs at Jesus' feet, the Santa dogs at Jesus' feet, there's no presence in the future.
In the future.
Flitting in the slitting scene of slowness in the slips. Flitting in the slitting scene of slowness in the slips.
The Residents were four art students from Baton Rouge who scandalized everyone in 1972 with a primitive record they put out that Christmas, Santa Dog. Already the elements were in place, primitive sound, hollow-sounding percussion, breathy vocals. Upon the release of their album Meet the Residents, which featured a picture of the Beatles with their heads replaced by crawfish, the band moved to San Francisco, where they live to this day. Militantly anonymous, they pioneered in deconstructive versions of rock and roll songs and moved on to make their own determinedly obtuse pop sounds. Naturally, sticking with it as long as they have, the Residents have picked up quite a following, and they even got to the point where they toured, each wearing a huge opaque eyeball to preserve his anonymity. They wear these outfits on the cover of their masterpiece, Eskimo, an album that attempts to invoke the life of the Inuits through the Residents' patented sound. If the Residents started as reaction and mellowed into artists, Pere Ubu started as deliberate avant-gardists. The band coalesced around 1975, the brainchild of two writers, Peter Loftner and David Thomas. Determinedly evoking the likes of Albert Eiler and Captain Beefheart, they reinvented song structure, and songs like Final Solution were as close as they got to being mainstream. Vocalist Thomas, jolly and fat, called himself Crocus Behemoth, and his voice was as unsettling as his stage presence. Somehow, Mercury Records, in the first days of punk, saw something in Pere Ubu and signed them. The resultant album, The Modern Dance, was a monster.
Down at the boss, man from Mandra, end of the town, man from Mandra, a poor boy, can't get on fly.
Unfortunately, Loftner died before it was recorded. The band, without his warped pop sensibility to steer them, sailed forth into previously uncharted waters, making records like nobody'd ever heard before.
What do you do with a drunken sailor? Who do you see in Caligari's mirror? How do you like the prankster's cheats? What do you see in a drunken sailor? Who do you see in Caligari's mirror? Why do you like the prankster's cheats so early in the morning?
This song, Caligari's Mirror, appeared on another major label in 1978, but as you might expect, despite great reviews, it sold horribly in this country. Pere Ubu kept at it for 3 more years, but the seeds of trouble were already evident by their third album, New Picnic Time, which featured a track called Jehovah's Kingdom Comes, a reflection of David Thomas's increasing involvement with the Jehovah's Witnesses. Debt-ridden and unsuccessful, the band flew apart in 1981 and reunited last year for an album. By then, they sounded almost normal, or hardly as weird as they had a decade earlier, a testament to their influence and importance.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
I did not see the darkened sky. I did not feel the pressure drop.
This is Fresh Air. A few years ago, animator John Lasseter exchanged his colored pencils and sheets of rough paper for a computer. Lasseter's last film, Tin Toy, won the 1988 Academy Award for Best Animated Short Feature, the first time a computer-generated film won the Oscar. Lasseter got his start doing traditional animation at the Walt Disney Studios, but his growing interest in computer animation led him to a job at Lucasfilm. Now he's with Pixar, a computer graphics company owned by Steve Jobs. In his early computer animation, Lasseter brought inanimate objects to life, a family of lamps in Luxo Jr., and a unicycle in Red's Dream. But in his latest, Tin Toy, he created a computer-animated baby. I wanted to know if animating a human is an especially difficult task.
In the computer, it is, because a computer has difficulty doing very organic shapes. The computer likes to do things, you know, that are very perfect. And the baby, of course, is very organic. Also, what's difficult about it is that from the audience standpoint, they know what a human looks like. They know what a human moves like. And so as an animator, trying to do something that becomes convincing for the audience, it's very difficult. The old animators at Disney used to always complain about being assigned animating the prince in whatever fairy tale they were working on. They'd rather do the talking rabbits and things like that, because no one knows what a talking rabbit moves like. So,
how close do you think you got with the baby?
We're kind of still a ways away. I think the story was that the baby was really like a baby monster, so we were able to...
Right, like the hulking baby.
Yeah, right. So we were able to make it kind of horrific looking, you know, in a way. You know, as far as like trying to reproduce humans with computers, we're still a long ways away from it. And to be honest, I'm not sure if I, you know, that's the direction we should go. And we have a little slogan saying reality is just a convenient measure of complexity. You know, so that's a way that we can focus in on developing the proper tools.
Let me ask you a few really stupid questions, okay?
Oh, great.
Say, say you're doing the baby for Tin Toy. Do you draw the baby? Or do you feed in a picture of a baby? What's the origination of the image?
All right. In the 3D computer animation that I do, there is no drawing except in the preliminary stages. What we do is there's three basic steps. There's a modeling stage, where you create within the computer a model, a three-dimensional model of the baby. The next stage is animation, where you take, and very much like moving a G.I. Joe around, you know, it's like you animate the rotations of the shoulder and elbows and so on. The third stage is a rendering stage, and that's a stage where you take every surface that you've modeled, and you have to indicate a color, you have to indicate how shiny it is, whether it's got a texture like a wood grain on it or not, and then you have light sources that you give. You say, okay, what color the light is, how bright the light is, how far does it drop off, and so on, and whether it's got shadows or not. And that is, and then you let the computer, once you've done all that, then you let the computer sort of go and compute the final image and create sort of, you know, the colored image with the shading and shadows.
Okay, another really stupid question. When you're indicating to the computer what color it is, you're putting in a little bit of that color, right? You're not typing in blue.
You know, no, I'm not typing in blue. I'm actually typing in values of red, green, and blue. Like a nice blue would be about, I'd say, like, out of between 1 and 100, it would be like 20, 10, and 80. That's a really nice blue that we use all the time.
So still, you're typing, basically. You don't have a paintbrush in your hand.
You're correct. Sometimes I do long. My background is in traditional drawing and painting and so on, and sometimes I really long for the feeling of a 6B pencil on a rough tooth paper. You know, there's that wonderful feeling you have. And so, needless to say, all my notes that I write now are with 6B pencils on very rough paper.
Well, since you've described what it's like to animate a human, let's talk about computer animation of an inanimate object and giving the inanimate object some human type of characteristics, lifelike characteristics. Your cartoon Luxo, let's look at that. It's about...
Luxo Jr.
It's about a parent and child lamp, two lamps.
Right.
And describe what a Luxo lamp looks like.
Luxo lamp is they're commonly known as like an architect's lamp. They're sort of the lamps that clamp onto the side of a desk and can bend way over. They got the springs and the long rods on them. And Luxo Jr. was actually started when I was trying to find something to model within the computer. I had a Luxo lamp on my desk, and so I just started modeling that. And then started this second stage, I started animating it and giving it life. I love to give inanimate objects sort of a personality. See, with computer animation, I think there's a lot of people that get excited about computer animation purely for the fact that it's created with a computer. And what I wanted to do, my background is in traditional animation, I wanted to very much to make this something to where people didn't look at it because it's made with a computer, but because of the characters in the story.
I think the most obvious cliched way of bringing a lamp to life in a cartoon would be to give it a face so it could smile or frown, give it eyes so it could cry.
Sure.
Now, you brought these to life without doing that. They looked just like lamps. But what kinds of considerations came into play in giving the lamps charisma?
Charisma. Well, I studied a lot in school and through my career, like Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin in their sense of pantomime.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I guess when I create a character, I always think about the personality. I try to get that solid in my mind before I do any of the animation. So when the character starts to do something, I sort of imagine what this character, how it would do it. And especially when comparing two characters like a baby and a parent as the two lamps, you know, I just wanted to give it some pathos and that warm and fuzzy feeling, you know, after he pops the ball.
What can computer animation do that hand-drawn animation can't?
When I first started working with computer animation, I really felt like, you know, the best thing about computer animation is the most difficult thing to do with hand-drawn animation and vice versa. Now, what computer animation can do is it can create really three-dimensional objects and move around those, and they stay completely rigid. They can shade, shadow, you know, light things. They can give almost a realistic quality to objects that you then can animate. That is very difficult to do with hand animation, to create real, like, airbrush-style shading on the characters that doesn't jitter over through the animation. The difficult thing to do with computer animation that's easy to do with hand-drawn animation is organic shapes and moving those shapes around. Most of the Disney characters are just these really wonderfully kind of squishy characters in a sense, and they move around. They have a sense of solidity to them, but they're real flexible. to try to do that with a computer, it's really quite difficult. The baby in Tintoy was our sort of first attempt at that character. And I see it as just a beginning. We have a long way to go in working with those types of characters with a computer.
Is there a big generation gap now forming between the older animators who are working with drawing animation and the younger animators who are going into computers?
Actually, no, I don't find that. There was before my work started appearing with computer animation, because I think a lot of people working with computer animation were the same people that were developing the tools, the programs, and it's kind of like, you know, all the paintings being done by the chemists who create the paint.
Yeah.
You know, and so once I started working with a medium, a lot of the old animators, namely two good friends of mine who are like my mentors, are Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnson, two of the great Disney animators. They look at the work that I do and are very envious. Ollie told me, he goes, "Oh, I wish I was young again. This is really exciting. Seeing this is like a, you know, one of the first new technical advances within animation in probably, you know, 40 years or so."
If you had your way, would you be making cartoons that would look so real you'd think they were a movie?
If I had my way,
yes.
I would create animation that had a quality that people would sit there and look at and go, "Is this real?" You know, but obviously it wouldn't be real. I don't want to create animation that is just sort of reproducing, you know, old actors or reproducing reality in just an easy way. I want to get that sort of paradox within the audience where they're sitting there. How was this made? What, you know? Yet that wasn't the focus of the film. The focus is the characters and the fact that they're moving the audience in some way or another.
Do you think regular animation will ever become obsolete?
Oh, absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
See, the thing is with a computer, it's not replacing anything. It's a new tool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as though someone came up with a really cool new pencil. That's what I look at it. A computer is just a cool new pencil. And it can do things really well that other mediums in animation cannot. But it cannot replace everything. You know, and I really look at the future is in the combination of traditional animation with computer animation, with model animation, and so on. You know, that style of animation is very, as I think, you know, going to be very exciting in the future.
Animator John Lasseter. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what's your big story from China today?
Well, we'll be hearing what's happening in Tiananmen Square in Beijing today, but also we'll be talking with a number of American China hands about the Chinese leadership. Li Peng, the prime minister, who it seems, there are many indications, but nothing confirmed, may be already out of office. There have been many demands, obviously, for him to leave. Also, who is Zhao Ziyang, the man who would seem to gain from Li Peng's ouster, how Deng Xiaoping figures in that, and what it means that Wan Li, a senior Chinese official who was visiting the United States, left early today to return and do his job.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John le Carré, the British spy novelist who is a former spy himself, has given us books like The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, Smiley's People, and A Perfect Spy. Le Carré, whose real name is David Cornwell, has just written a new novel called The Russia House. It's being touted as his first glasnost spy novel. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
John le Carré does several things exceedingly well in his new novel, of spies who can't decide whether they want to come in out of the Cold War. He evokes the cities of Moscow, London, and Lisbon, of which he apparently approves, and Leningrad, which he seems to despise. He is rhapsodic on the virtues of innocence and loyalty, but mourns them, too. They belong to some other century. He's created a Russian heroine, Katya, sufficiently plausible to permit me to forgive him for his earlier heroine, the Little Drummer Girl, a contemptible caricature. And he's created a Russian hero, the pseudonymous Goethe, sufficiently complicated and mysterious to permit us to believe in his genius. My ideas, says this Goethe to a British agent, are obtained from, 1, the paper tablecloths of Berlin cafes in the 1930s, 2, from the publications of my more gifted competitors, 3, from the obscene fantasies of generals and politicians of all nations, 4 from the liberated intellects of press-ganged Nazi scientists, 5 from the great Soviet people, whose every democratic wish is filtered upwards by means of consultations at all levels, then dumped into the Neva, and 6, very occasionally, from the mind of a distinguished Western intellectual who drops into my life. This Goethe, a poet, an artist, and an engineer, manages to smuggle to the West a mind-boggling manuscript. Unfortunately, the rest of the Russia House is a great gray lump. We're expected to root for a listless British agent, Barley Blair, whose scruples were far more persuasively embodied in The Honorable Schoolboy, Le Carré's best novel. We're expected to listen to a narrator, the hapless Harry, who confuses his sex life with the fate of nations. We're expected to believe that Soviet-guided missiles can't hit anything they're aimed at, and that the intelligence communities and the military, industrial, and Oedipal complexes of the West will do anything to keep this weakness a secret. Inside these thickets of prose, there's a single interesting idea. Hapless Harry reflects that one agent, dealing in human nature, is a primitive, whereas another, to whom human nature was one vast, unsavory quagmire, enjoyed the reputation of a modernist. Goethe's onto something similar when he says to Barley, "In chess, one chap has a strategy, and if the other chap doesn't spot it, or if he relaxes his watch, you win. In chess, the theory is reality. But in life, you can have a situation where a player has such grotesque fantasies about another one that he ends up by inventing the enemy he needs." That, too, is modernism, the self as other, James Angleton and his famous Mole. But this idea is plowed under as the novel strains for greatness, and oh my, does it strain, so self-admiring of every subordinate clause. It mentions in passing such Russian writers as Tolstoy, Pasternak, Solzhenitsyn, Bulgakov, and Brodsky. But it stretches westward also to include Stendhal, Conrad, Kafka, E.M. Forster, Garcia Marquez, and José Ortega y Gasset. This is uppity. Somewhere along the line, Le Carré decided that entertainment was beneath him, and that feeling bad at enormous length in compound sentences from several different points of view amounted to literature. It doesn't, and this isn't.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Russia House by John Le Carré. Here's a look at the next fresh air. In the 70s and early 80s, Boss Gags was one of the top rock performers around. After a 7-year hiatus, he recorded again a year ago, and now he's ready to go back into the studio. On the next Fresh Air, a talk with Boss Gags. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording by East German baritone Olaf Baer. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Salad. Production assistance from Lisa Bruton and Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Laura Sivitz. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.